The next couple weeks, we're going to be starting looking at the story of Scripture. And a few things to let you know up front ahead of time. First of all, this is kind of the breakdown as we're going to make our way through the Old Testament. That's what we're going to do. Notice that's only 4 days that are like an hour-long periods where we're going to cover the entire Old Testament. So obviously, we're not reading every word. We're going to try and hit the high points, and hopefully it will be in a way that you... My ultimate goal is that you're reading this and you're going to go, oh my gosh, I have known all these stories for a long time, but I didn't realize how interconnected they were, and I'm suddenly seeing them in a whole new light that I can't believe I didn't see before. That's what I'm hoping happens. Or you're saying, oh yeah, I've seen it in this light the whole time, and I had really good Bible teachers my whole life, and it just totally made sense, and you didn't teach me anything new. Either of those I would be pleased with. What I'm not looking for is two reactions. One is I'm way confused, and I don't even care what's in here anymore. That's one possible reaction that I hope doesn't occur. A second possible reaction that I hope doesn't occur is where you're just completely lost and trying to understand it but can't. So if that ends up being you, where we're racing through this text and you're just not seeing what I'm seeing, please. And people say this all the time in churches and youth groups and lessons or whatever. You come talk to me. Please come talk to me. Teaching the Bible is definitely my passion. And so if it's not coming across and you need more help, I want to help. And I will devote all kinds of time to answering questions, helping you understand better. So don't feel weird about asking for more help. All right, I think I got all this. Last little bit, this whole section of Scripture, all the Old Testament, is not about you. It's shocking to hear that from a Bible teacher. Yeah.
So are you saying that one psalm where it tells me I'm going to prosper, is that about me?
It's not. Yeah, and I do mean to shatter dreams right now, because if the dreams are wrong and lies, then they need to be shattered.
Is it Jeremiah 29:11?
Yeah. You are mentioned in these pages. We're actually going to see places where you're mentioned, but they're very few and far between. The point of this book is to tell a story, and you're supposed to recognize where in the story you are. You're not supposed to apply the whole story directly to your own life. And that's a step in Bible interpretation that just seems to have gone by the wayside. And that's the error that I'm noticing in the churches, is that we don't teach people the story of Scripture anymore, so you can look at the whole thing and say, now how does this actually apply to me? We just skip the middle step and say, yeah, it says you, he's saying second person, I love you, and I'm going to care for you, and that means he loves me and he's going to care for me. It may mean that, it may not. You have to look at it in the context of the story. The whole Bible is one unified story. So
if the Old Testament says that God loves you, it's probably not true.
It might not be true. No.
Wait. So what?
Or rather, it might not be what that passage is saying at all.
Not based on that passage.
Yes.
So how do you know what a book is like? Who is talking in each book?
It'll tell you, yeah. Huh. Or, yeah, you might have to use the context to determine it. You might have to, we'll get
but
to that.
Bizarre, say, like,
basically, what I'm hoping to teach you here is reading comprehension 101. It should be stuff where if you just slow down and read what it actually says, you're just going to be going, duh. But we don't do that anymore.
Basically ask all the questions, like who, where, when.
Yeah.
It all matters.
Who, what, where, when, why, how, etc. But yeah, if you feel purposeless through the next couple weeks, I'm not quite apologizing for that, because the point of all this is the majority of this book is so that you can know about it to better interpret these pages that do apply to you. All this is information that helps you better understand how these matter in your life. So what we're going through incredibly important. You don't understand this, you're going to get these wrong. But you got to go through this first, and you're going to be like, well, why am I wasting my time with this? The end game is quite a large gain. It's just, it takes work. It's hard. So, a preface, if you're not already bored, hopefully you won't be for the rest of the afternoon, but there it is. So, here's a look at what we're going to do today. We're going to review and catch up what we've covered so far. Right now we've covered Genesis 1 through 3 of the last 2 weeks. We're going to cover quite a larger section today. And then we're going to follow the story. We're going to look at the main characters. We're going to look at the plot points and what's happening in this one big unified story and how it progresses up to a certain point. Basically, we had to stop at Moses, or really Judah, going into Egypt, because that's as far as we could get in the time that we had. Because it's a long story. So we're gonna work our way through it. Something else I wanted to say, but I've forgotten it, so we'll keep going. Review and catch up. Oh, yeah. So there's an analogy I wanted to give you. Has anybody here read Lord of the Rings?
Oh, wait. No.
Yeah?
I've seen all the movies, so.
Okay, so you know there's four books in the Lord of the Rings, right? There's The Hobbit, which he wrote first, and then he wrote the three later books.
The shortest one.
Yeah.
Which was in three movies. I just want to point that out.
Yeah.
Full Pony.
Absolutely. Thank you. He wrote The Hobbit. Years later, he wrote the three following books. If you read The Fellowship of the Ring, what's at the beginning of The Fellowship of the Ring? Anybody?
The prologue. Explanation of how the ring came to be and
all that
stuff.
He gives you the history of hobbits, and he gives you basically a summary of the book, The Hobbit, so that you know what you need to know to get on with the story. What we're going to do today is, and for the next couple weeks, is the summary version of this whole big, long story. In the introduction of the Fellowship of the Ring, he gives you a whole book in one chapter. And so we're going to try and give you a whole book in four lessons. And so we're hitting all of the high points, the most important ones, the things that you need to know to understand the story. But there's a whole lot more, and it's a whole lot. It's incredibly intricate and beautiful. The more I read this story, the more you notice and how intricate it is, and what the old adage, the greatest story ever told. I fully believe that as literal 100% truth. It is the greatest story ever told. It's incredible how many themes and allusions and continuities and intricacies are woven into this story. Good. Somebody's yelling. That's
it. Now you're on
okay. So hopefully you'll see a little bit more of that. Okay, so we'll stop prepping it and just get into it. So, the review and the catch-up. Started off with Genesis 1 through 3. Somebody summarize Genesis 1 through 3 for me. What have we covered so far?
He created everything.
He created everything. That's what we did last week. Creation. The week before that, we talked about the fall, right? What goes on in that?
Creates man, tells him not to eat from a tree. They eat from the tree. They die.
Yeah, nice summary. Well, Adam really screwed it up, but... Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was the woman's fault, obviously.
I mean, technically the snake shouldn't have been in there, but...
So, yeah, he created everything, created man, created woman, told him don't eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They do. And so, he dishes out some punishments. Now, he told them, in the day you eat of it, you surely will die. In the day they ate of it, did they die?
No.
Not physically.
Maybe spiritually. I'm looking at this just as a reading a story. He says they were going to die the day they ate of it. They didn't. Either he means something different from the day. The day you eat of it, you will surely die. Okay, that means like the lifetime you eat of it, you surely will die. It means that he means something other than what we think of as die. Or it means he gave grace where he was not required to. they should have died, and he spared them some time. Some gave him a promise to fix the problem. That's how I would go about it. Spiritual death, feel free to take that interpretation. It's legitimate, and it's definitely the majority. Either way, they don't die right away.
But death enters the world.
Yeah, death thinking, enters the scene.
I was thinking maybe because maybe when he said the day you eat of it is the day you will die is like no, there was no death until the sin was committed. So therefore, sin didn't enter until they ate of it. Like,
so they started dying.
Yeah, they started dying.
That's an interesting thought too.
Because I was just going to say that. I mean, I've heard that the minute you're born, your cells.
You're dying from the baby.
Yeah.
When do you start starting a drink and stop finishing it? Yes. No. Okay. At what point do you start finishing a drink and stop starting a drink?
After the first drink.
Yeah. No. Okay.
Yeah. We've got too much to come.
Okay. Genesis 3:15. That's the key verse, though. It sets up the conflict for the whole rest of the story. What does Genesis 3:15 say? This is why you want your Bible out. You flip it over.
Snake heel. You will bruise your head. You will bite you.
Aaron, you get it.
I'll put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the heel, and you shall bruise him on the head. Wait, he shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the head.
Yeah. There's going to be this seed. There's going to be some conflict between Satan and the seed, and the seed is going to crush the serpent's head. That's the first promise we have of a seed. The whole rest of the story is looking for that seed.
The conflict between Satan and the seed, what exactly? Because, I mean, obviously,
it's a little bit
good and they're bad, but that's kind of weird to say, right?
It's a little bit confusing right now. We don't really, somehow, for some reason, that's the promise that he made of how the serpent's going to get his comeuppance, is by this seed. I'm glad that you're like, that doesn't quite track, because it gets fleshed out as the story progresses. This is the first mention of Jesus, first mention of the gospel, Genesis 3:15. There's going to be this seed. The rest of this story is looking for that seed. Who is this seed that's going to crush the serpent's head and who will be bruised on the heel? And that's the promise of hope. Chapter 4, verse 1 starts off with Eve expecting Cain to be that seed. I've gotten a man-child, the Lord. And Cain grows up, and his brother Abel grows up, and what does Cain do? Cain kills Abel. So Abel's obviously not the seed. Cain's obviously not the seed. He's sinning. So we're moving along. We got to find another seed. So here's a thing that we, with the benefit of hindsight, can look at this whole story and say, oh, okay. So looking at how the seed was presented and how we know who the seed was, what are some of the qualifications that the seed would have? Sinless and beat death. Those are going to be the two things that the curse gave that the seed rectifies. And as we'll see how we come to that conclusion as we're reading the story. That's the fall of sin and death. We're looking for the seed. That, if you're going with strict dating, approximately 4,000 BC. Feel free to disagree with that. We talked about that last week. Then we got the flood. Chapter 6. So flip over to chapter 6. Man's been living on the earth for a while, and we get this weird story about the sons of God who saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took them as their wives, any they chose. God basically says, I'm done with this. My spirit shall not abide with humanity forever. His heart is constantly on evil continuously. Chapter 6, verse 5. And so he says, I will blot out man whom I've created from the face of the land, animals, creeping things, the birds, everything's going to die.
How did the birds die?
I don't.
They have nowhere to land.
Yeah. They get tired from falling, from flying. Die of exhaustion.
Josh, you didn't think birds of the land?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Not that we have to go all into it now, but Nephilim.
Yeah, that's another lesson for another time.
No, I know, go. That's what I'm saying.
Isn't that like a...
Yeah, some kind of research.
Huh?
What is that?
We can put that for a future home group meeting.
Yes.
Or you can do a blog post.
Or I can do a blog post on it. I actually have done a blog post on it. Go read. Go to my blog and search flood in the search bar, and it should come up as a universal flood necessary. And who are the sons of God? Genesis 6. Two things. So with the flood, who's the main character in the flood? Noah. Yeah, Noah's the blessed guy in this generation. He was blameless in the generation that Noah walked with God. So that's going to be a phrase that we see a lot. Okay, nobody's walked with God again since Adam and Eve were walking with God in the garden. So Noah's a pretty good guy. Is Noah the seed? So we read the story of the flood. You guys know the story of the flood, right? He builds the ark. The flood comes, kills everything on the earth. He gets off the ark, and then stuff happens. What happens after he gets off the ark and they start rowing?
Gets drunk.
Not before that. Yeah, Noah gets drunk. Noah gets off the ark, starts procreating with his wife, and his sons start building civilization again. He starts making wine, gets himself drunk, and has a little run-in with Ham. That's the end of chapter 9. Okay. Ham is his son.
Shem, Ham, and
Jacob.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so he gets this little back-and-forth thing with Ham. But end of chapter 9. Chapter 9, verse 29. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Okay. The fact that he died tells us what?
That there's still death, and they're not perfect.
There's still death, they're not perfect, and...
The seed hasn't come there.
Noah's not the seed. Approximately 2341 BC. If you're going by the strict... Notice how much time there was in between that. We often forget that, by the way.
Huh.
1600 years of history in between creation and the flood by the most conservative estimates. So the flood wasn't totally unjustified. There was a whole lot of history for people to get really, really, really wicked. If you remember it, stop me. Feel free.
So the seed, basically, whoever the seed is, somebody who won't die because they're perfect?
Well, yeah, they're going to beat death. So we're assuming he's not going to die, and that's part of the twist ending of the story.
I mean, that's right.
The fact that he dies.
So,
yeah.
When he bruises his heel, that's Jesus' death, and then the full bruising of the head is him conquering death.
Crushing the head is the resurrection. That would be my interpretation, yes.
But he did die, though, so technically would
he beat death, and he came back.
Okay.
He came back. But right now, we don't know any of that, right? We just know that there's a seed coming. We know he's going to crush the serpent's head. He's going to be struck on the heel. And
if only we can just not know.
Again, something that if you're reading in Hebrew, it's a little bit more clear. We're looking for somebody perfect. We're looking for somebody sinless, which is why Eve says when she bears Cain, "Behold, I've gotten a man-child, the Lord." She's looking for somebody who's perfect to fix the sin problem.
So that's why Jesus had to be 100% human, because he's a seed of...
The woman. Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Your systematic theology should start to come together, hopefully a little bit. Or you'll see where we get our systematic theology. It comes from the text, not the other way around.
But if the woman through he was, like, born from, if she wasn't perfect, wouldn't that make him... Or
yeah, so that's a whole other issue you got to deal with in your systematic theology. I think it's Adonai. I gotta check it in the Hebrew. But yeah, so it could be just master. It could be.
From what she knows the God that she walked.
No, Lord is Yahweh there. So, so we don't actually. We know that Moses, when he's writing, seems to indicate that he's talking about Eve using God's name. We don't need to get into that right now either. We're dealing with the story. All of that aside, we're looking for a seed. Okay, put it that way. We're looking for a seed who's going to end the enmity. He's going to get rid of fix the problem, sin and death. That's the problem. Who's going to fix it? Flood, Noah, he sins and he dies. Okay, he can't be the seed. Keep flipping ahead. Chapter 10, you get descendants of Noah. Chapter 11, you got the Tower of Babel. what goes on there. God tells them when they get off the ark, spread, scatter, multiply, fill the face of the earth. What do?
They build a tower.
They group together, and they build a tower. They do the exact opposite of what God told them to do. They say, let's get together, build cities. And God says in verse 6, behold, they are one people, they have all one language. It's the beginning of what they will do, and nothing they propose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down there and confuse the languages so that they might not understand one another's speech. Nothing will be impossible for them. Here's my logical way of thinking. Why is God stopping them from doing great things? Answer, they're still sinful. The seed hasn't been found yet. The problem of sin and death is still around, and so they can't unify and do impossible things until that's been dealt with. And so he goes down to confuse languages for their own good, because a sinful united society is still a sinful society.
Well, they only made the tower because they thought it would be closer to God. Is that what it was? Or did they build it for the reasons?
More like be like God.
It's perfect reiteration of the fall. Yeah.
Verse 4.
Thank you.
Says, then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth.
And God told them to scatter.
I told them to fill the face of the whole earth.
Like, let's do our own thing.
Yeah. And it's
a name for ourselves.
Perfect example. Reiteration of the fall, right? Eve, surely you will not be like God, knowing good and evil, and that's what she wanted. That's what man wanted. Man wanted to set up on his own and say, I can make my own rules, I can be like God, I don't need God to be God. And so, again, Tower of Babel is a perfect example of that, and God's like, look, you got to deal with the sin thing, I can't have you superseding me. So the Tower of Babel goes down, then we got Shem's descendants after that, and then chapter 12, I've got a heading in my Bible that says the call of Abraham, or Abram.
Yep.
Yeah. He's introduced, chapter 11, verse 27 through 32. Let's go ahead and read that. 27, chapter 11, verse 27. Now these are the generations of Terah, Terah, father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran, father Lot. Haran did in the presence of his father Terah, died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred of Ur, the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife Milcah, the daughter of Haran. The father of Milcah is Isaac. Now Sarai was barren, she had no children. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson. And Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his sons, Abram's wife, and they went forth together from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. When they came out of Haran, they settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years. Terah died in Haran. Okay. That's just telling you where Abram comes from. It tells you a little bit about who's on the scene now. And we're about to hear a whole lot about Abram, so giving you backstory of who's who. Abram, his nephew, Lot. They are going to be the two main characters for the next few chapters, okay?
Is Abram Abraham?
Yes.
Yeah,
we'll see
that.
Name
changes
This is good. No, I'm glad it. So, yeah, right now we just know him as Abram. We're only 12 chapters into the story. So, people who've read the book before, you know, they're like, oh, I know it's coming. His name's going to get changed to Abraham. But we don't know that yet. We got to follow the story and see how it develops.
See, the thing is, I know everything. Yeah. So even if I was reading it for the first time, I already knew that.
Yeah. Genesis 3:15. Chapters 5, 10, 11 were interspersed there in their genealogies. Let's look at chapter 5 to begin with. So flip back a few pages. They follow this same similar theme. So jump to verse 6. Adam has Seth. Verse 6. When Seth had lived for 105 years, he fathered Enosh. Seth lived after he fathered Enosh 807 years. He had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. Enosh, he lived 90 years, fathered Kenan. Kenan lived after he fathered Kenan 815 years. He had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. And Kenan lived for 70 years. He fathered Mahalalel. Kenan lived after he fathered Mahalalel 840 years, and he had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Kenan were 910 years, and he died. What are you hearing repeated?
They die.
They die. Every one of them dies.
And they live really old when they have kids.
Yeah. They're living a lot longer than we know today. But what started in Genesis 3, surely in the day you eat it, you will die. It's being repeated. Everybody keeps dealing with this same problem. Yeah.
In 24, Enoch was not, Enoch did that.
Good question. So we got this one guy who's an anomaly in this genealogy. And what does it say for Enoch?
He was in close fellowship with God, and then he disappeared because God did it.
What translation do you have there?
New Living Translation.
Yeah, so it says Enoch lived 65 years. He followed Methuselah. Verse 24, Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. And he disappeared would be another legitimate translation. So how do we deal with this? There's this one guy who didn't fit the mold. Is Enoch the seed?
Well, God took him, so he can't. How can he crush the head of the serpent?
He didn't crush the head, and he didn't bruise the heel. For some reason, Enoch seems like a likely candidate, but he didn't get the job done. God didn't have that in mind.
And it doesn't speak of sin.
So he just took him?
Yeah.
It never talks about it ever again in the Bible?
Talks about it in Hebrews 11. Oh. So that's where we get the justification for why NLT translated it the way they did. He walked closely with God. The word closely isn't in there. In Hebrew. But Hebrews 11, verse 5, says, by faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. He was not found because God had taken him. Now, before he was taken, he was commanded as having pleased God. Without faith, it is impossible to please him. So, Hebrews tells us translators, oh, yeah, Enoch, when he walked with God, it's saying he walked closely with him. You know, he knew him. He was intimate with him. So they feel justified in adding the word closely.
Wait,
I think
so
that's
what's
a
difference between the other one? He says he walked closely with God, but he...
It just says he walked with God. Enoch walked with God. And the reason that we get that is who has quote-unquote walked with God so far in the story?
Noah.
Adam and Eve. Right? Pretty upright, upstanding characters. So the author is communicating Enoch's of a different breed.
Yeah.
But... What we know from the story as it's progressing, he didn't crush the head of the serpent, he didn't have his heel bruised, etc. So he's not the seed because it keeps going. If he was the seed, the story'd be done. Yeah.
Just to go back just a tiny bit to
the
flood, when I was talking through this homeschooling with Josh, I actually went through. And calculated the years of the generations, because the flood, he said Noah was the only one, Noah and his family were the only ones who were worthy, righteous. And I'm thinking, well, what about all these long-living relatives that preceded them? And I went through and I counted, and I can't remember Noah's dad's name.
Terah? Noah's dad. Well, let's look. It's at the end of chapter 5. Lamech,
that's right. It ended up, whenever you figured it out, that everybody was gone. Like, all the predecessors were gone. So Noah was the only one in his line that left. Mm. I thought that was really cool, because it lined up.
It fits. God wasn't lying.
Yeah.
Lazy.
That's strange how that works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going forward on that. But if you read this book from in sequence, which I highly, highly, highly encourage you to do, if you don't have time right now, you're going to see, and he died, gets repeated a whole lot for pretty much every person who comes on the scene. And so I think that's what the genealogies are in there for. They're there to tell you the history, and they're there to tell you, look, these are all the guys who aren't the seed. We're trying to find the seed. We know he's coming from Eve's line, so we're tracing Eve's line. And we get to Abram. So this is where we spend most of our time, is on Abram slash Abraham. So chapter 12 is where we pick up. And we're just going to be reading a whole lot of this. So chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house and your land, and I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. What are the things that God promises to Abram right away?
Become the father of a great,
make you a great nation.
Make you great and become the father of a great nation. What else?
Bless you and make you famous.
Bless you and make you famous, make your name great.
And be a blessing to others.
Be a blessing to others. Those who curse him will curse, and
all the families of the earth will be blessed through you.
In you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Again, the ESV and ASB are your two best literal translations, and they're going to be helpful here, but I didn't have any extra. Then 6 through 8. So Abram did what the Lord said. He went to where the Lord told him to. Verse 6. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem at the Oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were in the land, and the Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. So what does he promise him there?
To your offspring, I'll give this land.
Yeah, to your offspring, I'll give this land. Notice the word offspring was used a couple times. Or was it? Oh, that's later. But the word offspring, same word as in Genesis 3. Right?
Mine says literally
seed.
Descendants.
Descendants. So the question you need to start wrestling with now is the word seed or offspring. Singular or plural?
Plural.
And when is it singular and when is it plural? Is it always plural? Is it always singular? Does it go back and forth? Genesis 3:15, when he says, "To your, I'll put enmity between you and between your seed, and he, your seed, shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel." That one's pretty clear. First time it shows up in Genesis 3, seed or offspring is singular. We're talking about a guy. He starts making these promises to Abraham, to your seed, I will give this land. Is he saying singular, reference back to Genesis 3, or is it plural of all of your kids who come after you? You use the context to determine it as best you can. Last thing he did was he built an altar to Bethel, at Bethel. Chapter 13, we're moving through the story, jogging along. Abram and Lot get into a little fight. Abram and Lot are arguing over who's going to go where. They're getting into all these squabbles, so they can't live together. So Abram says, Lot, you pick your land. I'll take whatever's left. Go for it. And Lot chooses the finest land. He sees the Jordan River, and he goes all the way down to the Dead Sea, and he says, I'll make my camp there. Abram stays in the land where God gave him. And then God talks to him again. Chapter 13, verse 14. After all that happens, the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, westward, for all the land that you see I will give to you and to your offspring, not the word, forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. Arise, walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I will give it to you. So Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre. Again, to your offspring I will give this land, and I will make your offspring as numeral as the dust of the earth. Singular or plural?
That'd be plural in that situation. Because
especially since he's talking about
dust.
The amount of dust he's talking about, I hope someone doesn't become that big.
Okay, so he used the word twice, right? Is it plural both times? I think we all agree, based on the context, second time's got to be plural. He says, your offspring will be like the dust of the earth.
Who's the first one?
Who can count the dust? to your offspring I will give the land. Forever.
Because it's not like he's going to have one offspring.
So is he thinking of a specific guy who's going to be his future offspring seed? Or is he thinking of the nation? Again, use the context to decide. I'm not going to force one down your throat. I'm just raising the question. You need to determine it. Chapter 14. Lot gets into a little bit of trouble. So Lot goes, picks the choicest land. He makes a bad choice. He's down in Sodom where all the evil kings live. Kings of Sodom just kind of wreck shop on him. Abram assembles an army, comes and saves him. And after Abram saves him, he takes all the spoils of the land, and he comes up, and this guy shows up on the scene named Melchizedek. Verse 17, chapter 14, verse 17. After his return, the defeat of Chedorlaomer, and the kings who were with him, the kings of Sodom, went out to meet him in the valley of Shavra. And that is this king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram, by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hands." And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. I just bring this up because it's going to be important later in the story. This is one of those things that, like, you're reading a mystery book, right? And they give you all of the stuff you need to solve the mystery, but you don't know you're going to need it until you get to the end, and you're like, oh, the glass was sitting on the table the whole time, right? That kind of thing. Melchizedek's one of those kind of characters. We don't really know why he's in here. He's a priest of God Most High.
Isn't that the first priest?
Yeah, that's the first time we see a priest in this story. First time we saw sacrifices with Cain and Abel, and we've seen Abram building altars and stuff, and all of a sudden there's a priest here, and he gives him a tenth of everything. And like, okay.
Yeah.
Cool story, bro. We keep going.
In terms of the land to be given to his offspring, wasn't it promised that the Son of God would descend from Abraham's line? So
haven't gotten there in the story yet, though, so I don't know what you're talking about.
We don't predict.
We know.
No, but the land.
We know that the seed.
Like a foreshadowing thing?
Yeah, I think it is. We know that the seed from Genesis 3 is coming from this line. They're telling us the line of where this seed is coming from. He's walking us through the people, and we're looking for this seed. And so Moses wouldn't be writing about these people if the seed wasn't coming from this line. So, yeah. I guess I'll go ahead and tip my hand, tell you my interpretation. I think that, yeah, when he says, to your offspring, to your seed, I will give the land forever, I think he's talking about Jesus. He's talking about the seed.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah. I think he's saying, to Jesus, I will give the land forever, because he's going to one day, according to my eschatology. Regardless, if he's not talking about just Jesus, he is talking about all of Abram's descendants, all the people who are birthed by him and his sons. Yeah.
Isn't there someone, and I'm trying to find it now, but I'm not fast enough, that talks about a priest in the line of Melchizedek?
Yeah, Hebrews talks about it a whole lot.
Okay.
Jesus is a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. That's why you're giving away the ending. Come on. Yeah, lots of these questions we're not going to get answered today. They're not going to get answered for like another 8 weeks, because we're in the first part of the story. Yeah.
Well,
8 weeks as in 8 weeks, or 8 weeks like in the Bible, how like 7 days?
8 weeks for us is when we're studying.
I was just asking about the offspring, because offspring can be a long line.
Exactly. And the word in Hebrew is just as innocuous as it is in English. We don't know. When we say the word offspring, we don't use it as much in English anymore. But when we do, it could be singular, it could be plural. And you have to use context to determine which one I mean. If I were to say to the Salmons, "Where are your offspring?" I'm probably using it in plural. If I'm... That was a joke, because they have a lot of kids. It would have been funnier if they were here. But if you're talking about one particular kid, you could still say, "Where's your offspring?" And I'm talking about Josh.
Oh, and my footnote also says like when Melchizedek is the king of Salem, it says that is Jerusalem.
Yeah, Shalom. Yes, king of Salem, geographically, Salem is where Jerusalem was. So, keep going. Chapter 14, he has that little run-in with Melchizedek, and then chapter 15 starts, and it says this in verse 1. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. But Abram said, O Lord God, what will you give me, for I continue childless? He told me I'm going to have offspring like the sands on the shores of the sea, and I've not even got one kid yet. What's the deal, God? Am I going to have to... Is my heir going to have to be Eliezer of Damascus? Is it not my kid? And Abram said, Behold, you have given me no offspring, and a member of my household will be my heir. Verse 4. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. This man shall not be your heir. Your very own son shall be your heir. And he brought him outside and said, Look toward heaven and number the stars, if you are able to number them. And he said to him, So shall your offspring be. And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. Okay. That's another phrase that sounds like it's just one of those secret things that we're going to come back to when you get to the end of the book. You're like, how did I miss that? He believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. Up until now, the righteous people have been Noah, and it's because he walked in the ways of the Lord. He walked in the ways of the Lord. He walked with God. Those are the righteous people. This guy, Abram, believed the Lord, and it was counted to him as righteousness. The mark for righteousness has changed. I'm going to come back to that.
You can see where you get annoyed with the New Living Translation.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like that book. that's a different book than the one I'm holding here. 15:13 through 16. The Lord said to Abram, Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation, and they will serve. And afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, you shall go on to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Why is God telling him this? Well, because it's going to happen. He's telling him the future. And the reason I pulled this out as a high point is because we're going to see that at the very end of the day when that prophecy starts being fulfilled. Yeah. But just remember that. So he predicts the Egyptian captivity because we know the rest of the story, right? Tells him, your offspring, yes, you're going to have kids. They're going to get taken captive. I'm going to judge Egypt after they get taken captive. He doesn't say Egypt, but... 18 through 20. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, To your offspring I give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, and the Kenizzites, and the Kadmonites, and the Hittites, and the Perizzites, and the Rephaim, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. He tells them what land he's going to give them. What land is he going to give them?
Basically, from the Nile to the Euphrates.
There you go, from the Nile to the Euphrates. He tells them, these are the parameters of the land I'm going to give to you and your offspring forever. It's going to be from the Nile to the Euphrates. Okay, again, spoiler alert, no descendant of Abraham has ever possessed a piece of land that stretched from the Nile to the Euphrates in known history.
Still
to this day, currently. What does that mean? Well, just another thing to think about. Chapter 16 and 17. Abram's, you know, God told him, look, trust me, you're gonna have kids. You're going to have a whole lot of kids. They're going to be like the stars in heaven. Innumerable count. But he's a little bit impatient. Chapter 16, verse 1. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. Sarah said to Abram, Behold, now the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go in to my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her. And Abram listened to the voice of his Sarai. So after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. He went into Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. It's a lot you could get into there, down in the weeds, but point is, Abram takes it into his own hands. He says, I've been waiting on God to give me this son. Hasn't done it. Sarai says, well, maybe you're supposed to get it by marrying my servant girl, and we'll have a kid that way. So is this kid the seed?
I'd like to say that this is the beginning of the strife and the conflict in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Because it's Arab. Hagar is the Arab line. And with Ishmael and Isaac is the Jews.
Yeah. You see in this story build, and starting to see again why there's so much strife in the Middle East, because both nations are saying, look, God promised us this land back in Genesis 15. Land from the Nile to the great river Euphrates. They're both saying, we're the descendants of Abraham. We deserve this land. That's where it comes down to. That's your real world application. Yes. So Hagar gets pregnant. She bears a son to Abram. Names him Ishmael. And we're thinking, oh, well, okay, maybe this is what God had in mind. Maybe this was the plan from the beginning. Is Ishmael the seed? Is he going to be the line that that we follow? Don't know. We're going to have to keep reading to find out. 17, 9 through 11. Jumping ahead in the story a little bit. God said to Abraham. So chapter 17 is where God changes Abram's name to Abraham. He says,
like he just starts calling him Abraham out of nowhere?
Well, he tells him, your name will no longer be Abram, you shall be Abraham, for you will be the father of a multitude of nations. Abraham means father of many. So he tells him, look, I'm changing your name. He gets on his case, he says, you shouldn't have had Ishmael. Verse 9 says, as for you, I shall keep my covenant. God said to Abraham, as for you, I shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant, which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You'll be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male throughout the household. Blah, 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 blah. Both are born. Yeah, that's good. So, the sign of the covenant with Abraham. What's the covenant? What's the covenant, fancy word for promise that can't be broken?
Have
the sign is you'll have a bunch of kids, and the promise was
the land from the Nile
to the river Euphrates, and that he'd have a bunch of kids, and
then he'd be famous.
And then we go all the way back to the first time he made the promises, right? Bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. All the families of the earth will be blessed in you, make you into a great nation, give you the land. Those are the things that God promised to Abraham. And so the sign that you're going to receive that promise is circumcision of the flesh.
Wait, so doesn't... Okay. So it means what it says. It doesn't mean, like, they'll be stripped away of their, like, sin or something. Like, it means circumcision.
No, it means circumcision. It means... that's going to be the mark that says you get to partake in this blessing that I'm.
That's why
I'm dishing out to Abraham.
Jewish thing to do.
Yeah. This is all set up for what's going on in the New Testament, way back when with Abraham. This was the sign, circumcision. So when you get to Acts 12 in the Jerusalem Council, and you're going, whoa, 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 are we talking about not having people circumcised? Can't have the blessings.
Oh, okay.
And they have to fight it out, and they say, well, let's figure out how this applies in our day and age. But we'll get there. That's all part of the story. So, chapter 17, verse 15. This is where we clear up the whole Ishmael or Isaac thing. God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her. And she shall become nations. Kings of people shall come from her. And Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. God said, no, but Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him. Note the word offspring there. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and multiply him greatly. He shall father 12 princes, and I will make him into a great nation. So he's going to keep his word with Ishmael, but the one who's going to get the covenant, who's the one who's going to, the offspring is going to come from. Again, I think seed is singular there. I will establish a covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him. I think he's talking singular, offspring, seed.
My version says for his descendants.
Yeah. Him. And it's the translated, it's still the same word.
Which that's something different because typically in the Jewish culture, the blessing went to the firstborn.
Yeah.
And this is not the case.
That's something we're going to see repeated a couple times.
Yeah.
That the blessing's not going to the right person, so it seems. But 17, 15 through 22 clears it up. Where's the seed going to come from?
Isaac.
He's going to be the covenant child. And yeah, Abraham, you're going to die. You're not the seed. Chapter 22. So we'll jump ahead a little bit. God decides to destroy Sodom because it's so wicked and evil. Abraham intercedes for Sodom. God says, okay, I'll still kill him. I'm paraphrasing. God rescues Lot. They get out of Sodom. Lot has sex with his daughters. Just telling you what happens. Chapter 20.
He's definitely not
deceived. Abraham and Abimelech get together. Isaac gets born. Finally, the promise of Isaac comes to fruition. Chapter 21. Hagar and Ishmael get cast out. And chapter 22, sacrifice of Isaac.
The almost sacrifice.
Which the Muslims believe Ishmael was the one in the story, not Isaac.
Correct. Chapter 22, verse 1. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him and his son, Isaac. There's plenty of sermons on this, so you can... hear those for yourself. What does he tell him to do, though?
Sacrifice his only son.
Sacrifice his only son.
Oh, sounds
Isaac.
Really familiar.
Yeah. In the land of Moriah.
Or I guess it doesn't.
Which, again, you look at Moriah on the map, you notice it's precariously close to Jerusalem. It's the Temple Mount. Again, spoilers. So, Abraham gets ready to do it. I thought this was particularly... just interesting. So us looking back at this story, knowing what's going to happen in the future, verse 4, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw a place from afar. Again, one of those little things that, you know, like you said, it sounds familiar. Mm-hmm. Mount Moriah is named the place where the Lord will provide. So verse 9 of chapter 22, when they came to the place which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood on it and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took a knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his thorns. Abraham went, took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the place, the Lord will provide. And it said, to this day, on the mountain of the Lord it shall be provided. Again, spoilers, we know that mountain. It's the Temple Mount. I've been there. I've been on that mountain. It's the same mountain that the temple's built on. It's the same mountain that Jesus was crucified on.
No way.
He was actually born.
No.
The city of Jerusalem is built on and around that mountain. Still to this day. Yeah. Well, it's yeah.
So do they like? Is that like a place where they're like, yeah, this is where Jesus died, or is it more like a?
Yeah, there's
yeah,
two.
This is where I live, and oh yeah, Jesus died here.
It's more like the second one for the people who
live
there.
Who actually live there?
Yeah, there's two proposed sites of the crucifixion: Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The one inside the city.
Be cool to see.
Yeah, you should go to Jerusalem. Everybody should. What does he say after that? Verse, starting in 15. And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven. Said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. I think he's mixing singular and plural there again. Some of you probably have the translation, shall possess the gate of their enemies. Singular makes way more sense. But yeah, I'll multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, obviously plural. But, and your offspring shall possess the gate of your offspring, and verse 18 is the critical one. In your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. That, again, foreshadowing, spoilers, that's the gospel message. You want to know what Christians are? That's us. Point to verse 18 and say, I'm right there in the Bible. You want to know where you are in the Old Testament? That's you. In your offspring, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. You are the nations of the earth, and you've been blessed in Abraham's offspring, Jesus. We're going to skip ahead. You know how you read the end of the book first?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. You never do that? We're going to do that right now.
I think I did for the right?
That's not how you do that, by the way.
But Galatians 3:8 clears up that whole is this singular or plural thing. This is why I think it's singular so many times when you're like, oh, maybe is it singular or is it plural? Good question. So, specifically looking at chapter 22, verse 18. In your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. In your offspring, is offspring singular or plural there? Is he talking about
singular.
In the nation of Israel, all the nations of the world will be blessed? Or is he talking about in one specific guy who will be descendant from you, all the nations of the world will be blessed?
The second one.
Yeah, that's how Paul understood it. Galatians 3, he puts this whole big idea. Read Galatians 3 with the story of Genesis in mind, and you'll be flabbergasted. I love that word. Scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, in you shall all the nations be blessed. So then those who are of faith are blessed, along with Abraham, the man of faith. So there's your spoilers. That's how it plays out. Back in 22, verse 18, when he says, in you all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. That's us. We're all the nations. We're being blessed in Jesus, his offspring. But we haven't gotten there yet. Is Abraham a seed?
No.
No. He sins and he dies. That's the best way to know that he's not the seed. So what about Isaac?
No.
So now we're moving forward a little bit. Sarah's death and burial happens in 23. Isaac gets married in chapter 24. He finds himself a wife named Rebecca. Chapter 25, Abraham dies. He breathes his last. He lived to a ripe old age. Isaac and Ishmael both buried him. And then Isaac's got some kids. What kids does Isaac have? Jacob and Esau. Somebody tell me the story of Jacob and Esau real quick.
Soup. Just kidding.
Yeah, okay, so it starts out with soup, right?
Oh, yeah.
Jacob and Esau are born. They're twins, right?
Esau's hairy.
Esau's hairy. Jacob came out second, but he told Esau's heel, right?
Yeah.
They grow up, they fight a lot, and Esau sells Jacob his birthright for some soup, and then Jacob steals Esau's blessing as the firstborn by impersonating him for his blind father Isaac. Esau just decides, I'm done with this, and Jacob gets sent off to Laban. So chapter 28, then Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and directed him, you must not take a wife from the Canaanite women. Arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethel, your mother's father. Take as your wife from there one of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you. You may become a company of peoples. The blessing gets repeated. You may become a company of peoples. Then we get to... So yeah, the promise gets repeated to Isaac in there. I'm skipping ahead because I'm running out of time. But promise gets repeated to Isaac, the same promise. I will multiply your offspring as the stars. I will give your offspring all these lands. In your offspring, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. That's chapter 26, verses 3 through 5. That's when God says it to Isaac. Isaac dies, so he can't be the seed. But what about Jacob and Esau? Which could either of them be the seed?
Which one does the...
Does what?
Sells the...
Esau sells the birthright. Jacob steals it from him. Steals the blessing from him.
Is it stolen?
Yeah, because
it
was given to him.
Wait, so Esau
got the birthright. Esau has both... So as the firstborn, Esau is entitled to both the birthright and the blessing. As a firstborn. They're two different things. Blessing is the thing that Isaac bestows on him in words and lays his hands on him, right? The birthright is just, I get a double portion of when he dies, I get twice as much stuff as you do. So the birthright is what he steals first, or steals. He trades it for a bowl of soup. And later...
He steals the blessing.
He steals the blessing.
Was the birthright... like a tangible thing, or was it just like...
Yeah, well, it's going to be money and ox and goats and everything that he gets when Isaac dies.
Yeah,
and he sold that for soup because he was hungry?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Must have been some good soup.
Well, and it says Esau despised his birthright. He didn't care.
Oh, okay.
He was like...
But then didn't he try to steal it back?
Yep.
Oh, that was Jacob trying to steal it.
He gets mad when Jacob steals his blessing and says, I'm going to kill him. But... Jacob runs off to Laban, and his uncle Laban, right, Rebecca's brother, and says, you know, I'm here. On the way, though, he has a dream. So, chapter 28, Jacob's on his way to Laban in Paddan Aram, and verse 13. So he's in this dream. He sees this ladder or this stairway going up to heaven with angels going up and down it. Verse 13, behold, the Lord stood above it, the ladder, and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until... I have done what I have promised you. So, which of the two sons, Jacob or Esau, is going to be, are we going to be looking for the seed in now?
Jacob. I mean, which of
us? Jacob. Yeah, Jacob's the chosen one here. He's going to be the one that we're looking for the seed in.
God bless you.
Notice he gives him the exact same promise.
Thank you.
Yeah.
He's going to give him the land, he's going to bless him, and he's going to make his offspring great.
Okay, so this is something that I have in here for a long time and never had answered. In verse 15, the end of it, where it says, I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that once the promise is kept, that he's not going to be around anymore for these descendants?
No.
Because it looks like he's almost putting a time limit or a time frame on it.
Yeah, so that's a big question. Let me give you the short answer. Logically speaking, there's two recourses. One is to say, he's not going to leave him until all of that was promised, which means we can either point to where it was fulfilled and say, okay, it's been done, he left him, or to say he's still with Jacob and his descendants. What does he mean by with? I will not leave you.
Right.
The other way is to say, which promise is he talking about? Because he doesn't say... Yeah, he doesn't say until I have fulfilled all that I have promised you in this. So is he talking about bringing him back here? Is he talking about the nearest antecedent promise? Right? He says, "Behold, I will keep you, and I will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you wherever you go. I will bring you back to this land." Yeah. That's, I think either of those is theologically sound, because I don't think he's left the people of Israel. He's still with them. But the nearest antecedent, the simplest interpretation would say, he's talking about the last thing that he said. I'm with you, I'll keep you wherever you go, and I'll bring you back to this land. That's what he's saying. I'm going to bring you back here.
So could that be the formation of Israel?
Yeah. Yeah, it could. Like in 1960, formation of Israel.
Or 48. Yeah. Or
48. But Jacob's the one we're looking for the seed now in. Chapter 29, he gets to Laban's house, he marries two of his cousins. I know, I'm just telling you a story. And then he has 12 kids with four different women, two of them being his cousins, and the other two being the servants of his cousins. Just telling you a story. Yes, the 12 tribes of Israel came from four different women, and they were moderately incestual. These are God's chosen people. Ooh, I'm not going to press that. Can you guys name the 12 tribes?
If you really look at it, if sin is sin,
Judah,
which it is, their sin of that is no different than our sin now.
I agree.
So.
Judah is one of them.
Is it the kids of Abraham?
These are the kids of Jacob.
Oh.
So yeah, who are the 12 kids that Jacob has?
Jacob is
Benjamin. So I just know it from the show.
Joseph's
one of them. Reuben was the eldest of the children of Israel. Simeon, Levi, Naphtali, Issachar, Asher, Dan, Zebulun, and Gad. Took the total 9. Jacob. Benjamin, Judah, Joseph, and Dinah.
What show are you talking about?
Joseph in the Coat of Many Colors.
Thank you for mentioning this.
The Broadway show.
Yeah.
Never seen it.
It's a great way to memorize the 12 tribes of Israel.
Sing it.
Reuben was the eldest of the children of Israel, and Simeon and Levi and Ex and Lin and Naphtali and Issachar and Asher and Dan, Zebulun and Gad took the total to 9. Jacob and sons, Benjamin and Judah, which leaves only one. Jacob and sons, Joseph, Jacob's favorite son. No. You guys, yeah, you seen that show? Okay. Yeah, it's a good show. You guys know the story of Joseph, right? So Jacob's story kind of dwindles down, and now we're looking at his sons. What's the story of Joseph? Somebody summarize it for me. You guys all have heard it many times, right?
His brothers were jealous of him, so they sold him into slavery, and he had dreams that God gave him the gift of interpretation or whatever, he could interpret dreams. He unwisely told his brothers about how one day they would serve him.
Right, so they sell him in slavery.
Yeah, yeah, so that's
I remember that.
Then he works his way up out of jail and slavery into being the right-hand man of Egypt.
Well, technically, he worked his way up there, and then the wife lied, and then he was sent back to prison, and then brought back out by the people.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right. Good. Everybody know that story fairly well?
Yeah. I mean, I've seen the movie enough times that I've read it, like, a couple times in the Bible.
All right. Good. Yeah. Which movie are you talking about?
The animated one. The good one.
Okay. Yeah, they do a good job there. Okay. It's a story of how God's prophecy to Abraham in 15, 13, 16 came to pass. he's making him a great nation, making his children like the sand and the sea. So, end of the story of Joseph. Where are all the tribes? Where are all 12 sons of Jacob and Jacob?
Egypt.
They're in Egypt, and they're multiplying. They're making babies.
What chapter are we in now?
We're in 48, 49, 50. Okay. The last few chapters. It's the story of how the line of the seed was preserved through the famine, right? We know that we're looking for the seed. We know he's coming from Jacob. It's going to be one of these 12 sons. Well, 11 of them are dying in Canaan of famine. And Joseph is over there in Egypt and gets them all to Egypt and keeps them safe. Story of how Israel became a nation. We see how they develop their identity. We skipped the passage of Jacob wrestling an angel. I wish we could have, but we said time. You've never heard that story? You guys need to read all of Genesis. Just sit down and read it, like a story.
How much
is it? Get, sit down and read the whole Bible, like a story. Do it in 90 days. Genesis is 50 chapters.
Man, I wish I liked reading stories.
Stories are great.
Yeah, he wrestles the angel, and then like he does pretty good, and it messes up his arm.
It's also a story of how Moses was born. So, end of Genesis closes. They're all in Egypt. Jacob's dying. He blesses all of his sons. He does some funky stuff, blessing Joseph's sons. Crosses his hands and blesses the younger one. Again, this theme we see repeated a couple times now. Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau, Isaac and Ishmael, and now Manasseh and Ephraim. The younger one gets the blessing over the older one. And then Exodus chapter 1. So, we're continuing the story. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with their household. Lists all 12 of them. Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. So, are any of those 12 the seed?
Nope.
Still looking for the seed. It could come from any one of these 12 tribes, though, because Jacob had all 12 of them, and he hasn't told us which one is coming from yet. Or has he? Sorry. Joseph died, all the brothers, now they're... I'm looking for the part where it tells you how long it's been, but I must be mistaken.
Is it like how in the chapter 5 of Genesis?
No, I'm looking in Exodus now. How long have they been in Egypt?
Does it explain how it, like, it explains in that fashion?
Yeah, so it goes back to... Well, no, it doesn't. No. Not like that. But they go to Egypt, and back from chapter 15, verse 13 through 16, there's that prophecy that's been fulfilled. Right? You guys know that story, right? So Joseph and all the tribes go down to Egypt, and actually when they're on their way to Egypt, Jacob says, no, we're not supposed to go to Egypt. And God appears to him and says, don't worry, I'm going to bring you back out of Egypt. And so he says, okay, I'll go. But all the way back in chapter 15, he had said, we went over this, right? You're going to spend, your offspring will spend 400 years sojourning in the camp of your enemies. They will be your servants, they will be afflicted for 400 years, but I will bring judgment on the nations that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. That's the story of Exodus. Story of the Exodus. Moses leads the people out of captivity, out of slavery. It's a great little story. So you see, hopefully you're seeing how there's a whole bunch of these stories, and they're all connected in one big overarching story that is started in Genesis chapter 3, looking for the seed. And we're progressing towards the seed. And there's layers that are being added. Now we got, okay, it's going to come from Abraham. Okay, now is it going to come from Ishmael or Isaac? Okay, it's going to be from Isaac. Narrowing the scope. Is it going to be Jacob or Esau? Okay, it's Jacob. It's going to be 12 from the 12 tribes. Okay, and then all of a sudden, you get into Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. These 12 tribes are exploding, and we got this whole nation that we're dealing with now, and God starts dealing with them on a national level instead of on a personal level. Okay, so these changes and these layers that get added to the story are what we're going to see develop. But there's always that baseline thing of where's the seed? one who's going to finish the enmity, Genesis 3.
So when you're reading the story of the seed, basically Christ, when he dies, it's supposed to be like a trick ending. You think he dies and he's not the seed, and then he comes back.
Yeah.
Plot twist. I'm alive.
It's such a different view.
Major plot twist. It was like, not only, okay, yeah, he died, so he was fully human, but he beat death. And then you see how the crushing, bruising the heel and crushing the head thing, oh, that's a metaphor that makes total sense. Yeah, he thought he had the, Satan thought he had the winning strike, and then he comes back.
When in the Bible is Jesus tempted, or not, my bad, Jesus is, when, like, when Satan's trying to, like,
he's tempted?
Yeah.
Before he gets
It's going to be the beginning of Mark chapter 2, Luke chapter 4. We know that.
I don't know what chapter.
You should learn before Jeopardy on Wednesday. Luke chapter 4, Matthew chapter 3? Somebody want to... It's in all of the Gospels, or it's in the three Synoptic Gospels at least. So, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all talk about it. All
right,
but we do know
Luke.
That he says
Luke
yes.
and Matthew are the two fullest accounts. Luke 4, and I think it's Matthew 3
yes.
or 4.
Last
little bit.
Beach trip last year when Denise.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Story.
You're making fun of his tease.
Real quick, so if we had the time to read all of these prophecies, I would, but so jump back into the story. We're in Egypt, Jacob's lying on his deathbed, and he's blessing all 12 of his sons. And he's dishing out blessings and curses, and he's telling them what's going to happen about them prophetically in the future. And he gets to one of his sons, Judah. So chapter 49, verse 8. It says, Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. For the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion and as a lioness who dares rouse him. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until the hapax legomena. That's until the tribe comes to him is what ESV says, and ESV says something a little bit different. It's a funky little phrase there in Hebrew that we don't really know what it means.
Okay, what verse is it? Until he comes to whom it belongs.
To whom it belongs? What do you got? What?
No.
NIV?
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 49, verse 10.
And then there's a... Oh, go ahead.
Hapax legomena is a... It means word or phrase that appears only once, or is... Another way of saying it is something that we don't exactly know what it means because of the original language. So.
And it has as a footnote, until Shiloh comes, or until he comes to whom tribute belongs.
Right. I don't even want to venture a guess right now. That's people have written whole dissertations on what that phrase means. No joke.
Until he comes to whom tribute belongs.
The important part, though, that you can get something from it is the scepter. Scepter shall not depart from Judah. A scepter is what a king holds, the ruler. He's pretty clearly saying that Judah is going to rule over his brothers in some future date. Again, I think that clues the reader in, oh, we should be watching Judah. What's going to come from Judah? Again, read the story. They're setting up characters. These 12 guys, these tribes that end up being descended from them, are all throughout this book. And so... Reading chapter 49 and 50, where he talks about, or chapter 49, I guess is the only one, where he talks about what they're going to be like, what their characteristics are going to be, really helps you understand the story. He tells you about how Dan is going to be a wonky character. He's going to judge the people as one of the tribes of Israel. He talks about how Simeon and Levi are weapons of violence. He does some interesting things with these prophecies, and I don't have time to get into it right now. We're over time. Last thing I gave you on your sheet, chronological order of the books of the Bible. Have you guys memorized the books of the Bible? Have you ever done that?
If I can see
one time.
I know a good portion of it.
I can see
That's one of those things that I think, by no means would I say it's necessary for a Christian to memorize all the books of the Bible, but I think it is very, 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 very good for a Christian to know his Bible backwards and forwards, and when you know your Bible that well, you also know all the books of the Bible. And so if you don't even know the books of the Bible, how well do you know your Bible? That kind of conundrum. But these are the books of the Bible, how they progress through time. In terms of what's recorded in them, what's taking place. So you got Genesis, Exodus and Leviticus are congruous, taking place at the same time. Genesis and Job are taking place at the same time. Numbers and Deuteronomy taking place at the same time. Then you got Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. Those are the historical books. Those books record the history. Okay? So the story that's going on, the history of it is in those books, in that order. Which is why when you read the Bible from cover to cover, if you don't understand this chart, it's really confusing. And you're like, I don't know what's going on here. But if you know that, okay, 1 and 2 Samuel are recording the same historical events as 1 Chronicles, and they're just written by a different guy with a different perspective, okay, it makes a little bit more sense. So when we read 1 Samuel, we can also flip over to 1 Chronicles and see what's happening at the same time. Same thing when you're reading all four Gospels, right? You can look back and forward and get a better picture of the history that's happening. This tells you, the reason I picked this particular chart to show you is because the way they organized the prophets was really nice. It tells you northern prophets, southern prophets, foreign nations, captivity, post-captivity. And that'll make sense when we get to that part of the story.
Are they congruent? Like Jonah, Nahum, Obadiah was at the same time.
Yes, they're fairly good. Okay. I mean, Jeremiah is obviously goes all the way to the end of 2 Kings and into the exile. All of these guys go into the first and second Kings camp. As do Amos and Hosea. They're in first and second Kings. Captivity, Daniel, Ezekiel, and parts of Jeremiah are in the exile. And then Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi are post-exile. So the bigger groups are.
Okay.
So yeah, if you spend a little bit of time with this chart, hopefully by the end of this series on the story, this chart will make a whole lot more sense to you. You'll be like, oh yeah, I know exactly why they put all of those where they did. Because those go there and those go there. Of course you would do it that way. Why would you do it any other way?
Yeah, that's the best. You know how they have those plans for reading the Bible in a year? I'm never good at following the ones that just go like Genesis and Matthew, and they go like that. But I found one time that did the chronological order, and that was really eye-opening.
That's something I recommend for everybody. If they're like, I want to read the Bible in a year, read it in chronological order. There's study plans all over the internet. Just Google chronological Bible
reading. Are you reading Genesis and then Job and then Exodus and then Leviticus?
Yeah.
Or is it... Oh, okay.
Or those plans will sometimes split it up and they'll say these verses. So you'll read like a section of 1 Kings and you'll read a big section out of Isaiah that took place at that time in 1 Kings.
If you start at the beginning and read 3 chapters a day, you'll get through the whole thing in a year. I did it 6 times.
Yeah.
So you did 6 years in a row?
But I will say something I've realized. Challenging yourself to read through the Bible in a year is wimpy.
Yeah, I heard people do it in 48 days and stuff like that.
48 days. Do it in 3 months, yeah. Seriously. If you were to sit down with the Lord of the Rings, if anybody in here is a reader, 3 months is a reasonable time to think, yeah, I could read at least the Fellowship. You're not going to do that with the book that tells the story that lays out the worldview that you hold. It's disgraceful when Bart Ehrman, famous atheist apologist guy, comes into an arena full of Christians and he says, how many of you have read the Da Vinci Code? Everybody's hands go up. Really? How many of you are Christians? Everybody's hands go up. How many of you have read the Bible cover to cover? Half of them, maybe, put their hands up. It's disgraceful.
But what's the Da Vinci Code about? Like, why does everybody like it so much?
They don't.
It looks like the boringest thing ever. I mean, the most boring. My bad.
It's not that great of a. It's not that great of a book.
But it had to do with Jesus.
Yeah. I don't think it did.
had to do with Jesus.
Really it takes the Gnostic Gospels, which are extra biblical, that aren't part of the biblical canon or whatever you want to call it.
Oh, like how we talked about that one time, all those books that we don't.
Yeah, but that's particularly the one what we talked about that day. They were the Catholic. But there's some that, like, were found later. Like, there's, like, supposedly the Gospel of Thomas and Gospel of Judas and all these
Mary
other things.
Assumption of Mary.
Yeah, that's what they're taking. No, that's...
If they were supposed to make
Yeah, there's a book, too.
Okay.
What did you say?
There's a whole bunch of, a whole group of people that believe that, like, part of it was Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married and had kids.
Because
that makes sense. All right.
So you guys know, next week... We're covering Exodus through 1 Samuel.
Yummy.
That's a big section of your Bible. So, something I might suggest doing is just flip through and read the headings of each chapter. Take you maybe 30 minutes. Read the headings of each chapter of Exodus through 1 Samuel. It'll help you out. But that's all. I'll see you next week. If anybody has money for me for Riggins, May 16th is when you're supposed to have at least $500 to
me.
I have
money. But I have money.
And something that Josh wasn't clear on, make sure it's clear for everybody. You don't have to give it all to me at once. You can give me a dollar at a time. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's $222.
Mine is less.
Congratulations.
I was going to give you like $225, but I was like, I'll take $3 a day, so I can say $222.
Okay. This is Michaela. Thank you.
I'm going to do 888.
What's 888?
Stephen, I had a question, but we don't have to do it right now. Okay. I'm going to get going. But whenever Jacob prophesies about prophecies, whatever the word is, about his sons, how he says about Judah, you will have the scepter and you will have the ruler's staff. Why is there a dichotomy? Not now, because I could go, but... That's something that I've pointed out too. The symbolism.
Yeah, I'll double check. My initial answer is pretty simple, and it's the exact same thing. Hebrew speakers do that a lot. They'll say the exact same thing two different ways. It's a poetic device.
Okay.
But I'll double check and make sure it's not something more than that.
Thank you.